We interview Lorraine Meisner. She is professor of pathology and laboratory medicine, professor of population health science, which was previously known as preventative medicine, and she is chief of the cytogenetics section of the Wisconsin State Laboratory of Hygiene. My name is Joyce Coleman, and the date is December 5th, 2003. So perhaps you could talk a little bit about your childhood and early education.
Okay. Well, I was born in Chicago, but due to the difficulty of finding work there, we moved to Detroit, and it was really tough. My father couldn't find work there either, so he started a small mattress factory and worked very hard to support us. Times were very tough. So mm-hmm. I grew up in Detroit on the wrong side of the tracks.
And this is during the Depression?
Yes. Okay. And learned many survival skills. And my deepest desire at that point was to get out of this social class and poverty and become a teacher. So I worked very hard in school and did very well. And, ultimately graduated from high school with very high grades at the top of my class, etc.
Now, what were your favorite subjects at the time?
Actually, I loved language. I loved everything. You know, I loved math and I loved languages. So I became fluent in French and Spanish. They let me take both.
So at that time, you weren't strongly interested in science?
I never took a science course.
Really?
I was really a very, very brainwashed female, thinking this would be just too much. So I never really had a science course. My high school didn't even have much. I think we had something about plants.
Mm-hmm.
But I did enjoy reading literature in the original French and Spanish, and I was almost expelled from school once because we were asked to write up a book report about Victor Hugo's 1848 in French,
mm-hmm.
which we read in French. And I was so moved by that I wrote a book report in Victor Hugo's own words. So they called me in for, I can't think of the word,
Plagiarism, right.
And they said, how could you do that? You were our best student. We're so disappointed. So I didn't know what they were saying. Oh, I said, I didn't do that. I said, look, I'll write another one. And I sat down and wrote another book report in Victor Hugo's own language. And so they felt so bad they gave me a scholarship to college.
So did your parents encourage you to do well at school?
Yes. Yes, okay. They did.
And were there any teachers at high school who particularly encouraged you?
Well, my language teachers were wonderful. And in fact, as I recall, all of my teachers were very good. My English teacher was especially nice. And, you know, we didn't take that much math in those days, but whatever it was, I loved it.
Did your parents expect you to go to college?
Yes, especially once I got the scholarship. But actually, I went to a city college, which was then called Wayne University. It's now Wayne State University, but okay. Then it was just and then you live at home and you take your courses. It's much like high school, crowded big classes and so on.
Okay.
And I started out in English literature. And I was quite happy reading, and I took other literature. But when we had to learn Old English, I balked. I just could not put YEs on the end of everything and so forth. So I decided maybe this wasn't for me.
Okay.
So I went into sociology, which seemed very easy and interesting. Now, at this point, my former husband, wanted to go to the University of Chicago. So in those days, you went where they went. So we went to the University of Chicago. And for a while, I went to the Art Institute of the University of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Where I studied, architectural history, art history, which was largely art. It was wonderful, too. And I loved doing that. But then I applied to the University of Chicago to enter their master's program, because then you didn't need a bachelor's degree.
You didn't need a bachelor's
no,
degree?
No, you just took an exam, and if you could pass out of everything, you entered right into the master's program.
Now, what degree had you gotten from your...
Nothing.
You didn't? Okay.
No, I had no degrees. I never got a bachelor's degree.
Really? Okay.
Right. So I took this exam, and I passed out of everything. But I passed out, I was in the 99th percentile in biology, and I'd never had a biology course. I did have an astronomy course in college, but not biology.
So where had you picked up your biological knowledge?
I don't know. I think they test your reasoning ability.
Okay.
So the dean of the college calls me in and said, perhaps you're in the wrong field. Oh, no, I said, you know, I mean, that would be just too difficult, you know. So I stayed in anthropology, and I studied with all those wonderful minds in anthropology, mm-hmm. and I majored in physical anthropology.
Okay.
After a while, and I was very turned on by that. But also, I was very interested in cultural anthropology and all the different behaviors that one saw.
Mm-hmm.
So I asked myself, you know, what was genetic and what was environment? And so I took a minor in animal behavior and genetics.
Mm-hmm.
And my first genetics course, it was like music going off. Then I took comparative anatomy, and it was so thrilling. I can't even, you know, describe how joyous it was to see how well the body fit together in every which way.
Now, were you starting off at graduate level courses, or did you?
Yeah, I started out in graduate level courses.
Really? And you just picked up all the background on your own?
Well, basically, I'm afraid that if I'd taken some of the undergraduate course, I might have been turned off. So this way, it was extremely exciting, except once I went into the biological sciences, then I had to take chemistry 101, 102, and 103, organic chemistry 101, and biochemistry, and all those little courses I hadn't taken.
Mm-hmm.
That was pretty much of a trial. The kids were much younger than me. I already had one child.
Okay.
Yeah, and it was fairly, you know, but anyway, I did it.
So just to clarify, you'd gotten married while you were an undergraduate?
Yeah, I was 19, actually.
Really?
I was very young. Right?
Okay. Were you younger than most of your friends, or at that time was
well,
that
Well, actually,
standard?
I graduated younger than most people.
Okay.
I think I was accelerated at some point.
Okay.
So I went to, anyway, I was in the University of Chicago, and so I was debating whether to get my PhD in anthropology or to go on to biology, and I chose biology, and they gave me a nice scholarship, so that made it easier.
Okay. I've got just a few more questions about anthropology before you leave
right.
that. Now, this is the early to mid-50s. What sorts of careers were women being encouraged to pursue?
Well, there were several women in our course, and you know, in our class, and a lot of them were ending up on digs. Some of them went living off in the jungle observing monkeys or gorilla behavior and
mm-hmm.
things like that. Jane Goodall type things. Yes.
So you're just saying that there were a lot of women in the program then?
There were a number of women in the program, right, and it was a wonderful program. And actually, there's a lot of sociology involved, you know. We read Durkheim and all
mm-hmm.
these wonderful thinkers.
Okay. Because I know that
Max Weber, well, all those things that really cause you to think.
Uh-huh. Well, I knew that within cultural anthropology, there's a strong tradition of women like Ruth
right,
Benedict, and
right.
I just wasn't sure if in
right.
physical anthropology
Don't
there
forget
was
Margaret Mead.
Oh, Margaret Mead, yes, of course. But
no.
I wasn't sure if in physical anthropology there were as many women.
Well, when you first start, you don't know what direction you're going to take, and then I sort of leaned to the physical and
mm-hmm.
to Washburn, who was very inspiring, and then he went to California anyway, didn't he?
Okay. Oh, could you talk a little bit more about Sherwood Washburn?
Well, he
major?
Was, I was fascinated by the way the human body evolved and worked. I mean, it's a miracle every time you think about it. And just seeing, you know, the relationship between the brain and the jaw and the muscles and how the skull got larger and people became erect, etc. It was just so fascinating to me. So this is why I went into physical, although frankly I was I love every aspect. I was next interested in linguistics because
mm-hmm.
of showing how people, what they find important is reflected in their language. And then there's cultural anthropology, which is really fascinating. So you can see every minute I spent in that field was not wasted.
So how did then you then choose physical anthropology if you liked all aspects?
Well, I decided that was most interesting. But
okay.
then I decided I couldn't go digging bones. And I wasn't going to go out on on a mission watching gorillas like Jane Goodall. I just wasn't up to that. Besides, I had a family.
Hmm. So then you chose to do zoology and genetics instead.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at this point, you didn't have a strong background in either of those areas. How
no.
did you compensate for your
background? I started at the top, and it never bothered me.
Really?
Right. as I said, in a way it was an advantage because everything was so new and exciting and I didn't have to mess with any undergraduate course. I never
Yeah.
took an undergraduate course.
Okay, so you missed all of the boring
That's
rote
right,
learning
right.
stuff.
Later on, I became a teaching assistant for some of those courses, and I did in genetics have to take courses of, you know, bacterial genetics, and I learned all about trilobites and the phyla and all that because I was a teaching assistant. But I mean, in a way, it was an advantage just starting out the top when everything was so exciting.
So what area within zoology and genetics did you become interested in?
Well, I was interested in human genetics from the start because my interest was to determine how much of the behavior I had seen and studied was due to environment and how much was due to heredity. So I asked my anthropology professors and they said it's mostly heredity. And I asked my genetics professors and they said it's mostly environment.
I would have thought the answers would have been opposite.
Wouldn't you?
Yes.
That's why I went into genetics. At that time, I believe the environment played a major role in your development.
I wonder if they would say this, give the same answers now.
I don't know. It was interesting, but, you know, because it's easier to, if you're studying behavior, to blame environment, I guess. Genetics, I mean.
Yeah, maybe when it came down to blaming.
You know, but basically trying to find out how it evolved that way. You know, why some tribesmen would experience pain at childbirth, and they'd actually be in pain. You know, why would that happen? With culture, I mean, culture is fantastic and what it can do to people and brainwashing and all, you know? Yeah, but I like the concept that we had more control, that our genes played a secondary role. But now, after many years, I think, you know, genetics is slightly more important than I originally thought it was, but it still interplays at every point with the environment.
Okay. So for your PhD program, was it mainly courses or was it mainly a thesis?
No, it was mainly courses in my case.
Okay.
Because I had nothing behind me, so there were a ton of courses. And then we had a prelim. And as I said, I had to do all the Drosophila work.
Okay.
To study genetics and all the viruses and all the bacteria. Because human genetics wasn't a field, really. I mean, I was sort of like the sociologist of the biology department. You couldn't mate humans. There wasn't a whole lot you could do with humans.
Okay.
You couldn't put them in a jar and study their chromosomes.
So wait, is this before or after Watson and Crick's discovery?
Oh, it's after, but it was still, in a way, a back science because, you know, there was so little you could do with humans.
Okay.
You know, actually, Sewell Wright was at the University of Chicago just before I got there. And so he did a lot of statistical analysis, but other than, and so you see that wasn't hard science, I mean, that wasn't laboratory science or anything.
Okay.
So I went through the whole program, but I was still interested in human genetics, and I was working under Herlof Stranskov, who was the student, he was next to, but not equal to, Sewell Wright.
Okay.
Sewell Wright came to the University of Wisconsin because they had a mandatory retirement age at Chicago.
Really?
Yes.
That's
and he worked another 30 years.
Wow.
And wrote till the end.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. I mean, he was writing when he was 96. And he left when he, can you imagine that?
Wow.
So there's another moral there that, you know, old geneticists never give up. So anyway, under Dr. Stranskov, I was noticing that he wasn't turning out many graduates. In fact, one every 10 years. I didn't have that long. And so somebody gave me friendly advice to look around. So I then began to work with under Hewson Swift, who is a famous cytologist.
Okay.
So you see where I ended up in cytogenetics.
Okay.
He studied cells and this studied genetics and they got put together.
Okay. So I want to ask, were there very many women in the zoology program?
No.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, there were fewer women there. In fact, there were hardly any people. I think there were, it was a very small class, maybe 12, you know, and very few women.
Okay.
Yeah.
And did that ever bother you, or did you face particular obstacles?
No.
Okay.
Actually, I mean, it was hard, and but I didn't really notice the obstacles. My main obstacle was being a mother. University of Chicago at that time didn't even want to take married women because they were afraid they were wasting the education. And one day I was pulling my son, who was then 6 years old, down the street in Chicago, and I ran into Herlof Stranskov, my major professor, And he looked down at me and he said, "Yours?" And I looked, he was 6'4". I looked up at him and said, "Mine." So he went off in a huff, and here I am, a student with a baby. Well, so he didn't actually, they were picking the teaching assistants the following day, so he didn't pick me. But Dr. Swift did.
Okay.
And he was a lot more tolerant than, of all these things.
Okay.
And I will say that I lived with my husband. He went to the Far East for a few couple of years after I took my prelims. And when I came back, Dr. Stranskoff let me TA his course, even though I had a baby in the middle of the semester.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. So, okay. You know, there was progress.
Yes,
you know, the kids would come up to the hospital and we'd go over their questions.
So how did you deal with having young children and being a grad student?
It wasn't easy.
Did you sleep at all?
No. I learned to, you know, I learned to do most of my work at night.
Okay.
And, you know, I think in a way it's beneficial to be a grad student when you have children because, well, first of all, it breaks up your day. You can't study all the time. You can't be a perfect mother all the time. But this way you really put yourself out in both times.
Yeah.
Both ways. And I remember I would study after they went to sleep, and sometimes I remember reading to Jeffrey and falling asleep with before he did. And then I'd wake up an hour later and he said, "What then?" He was very patient. And they didn't have daycare in those days. It was very hard. I'd have to switch off with friends.
Okay.
Who had similar problems.
Okay, so there were a group of women who had young children. And
well, not a group, but fortunately somebody in my building who was a night nurse.
Okay.
So we took turns.
Okay, that's interesting. I've heard another interview with a law professor. And she and a friend were both studying and they would take turns.
Yeah, well, this way when I was in class, she would sit. And then when I wasn't at class, I was at home. And we were very poor, so every night at 5 o'clock, I would go to the library and take our textbooks out and return them by 9 the next morning because they were on reserve.
Mm-hmm.
And so I never bought a book.
So that means all of your reading was done evening and
yeah,
middle
right,
of the night.
Yeah, right. And I couldn't underline, of course.
True.
So it forced me to take good notes.
Mm-hmm. So in some ways it encouraged
good
study habits.
It
probably taught you very good time management skills.
It really did. Yeah, it did.
Okay. So you graduated in 66.
Right. At that time, I had a couple more kids.
Okay.
And we were living in 1960, 61 is when we went to the Far East.
Okay.
And then we came back for a short period of time. I'd already done my prelims. It was a question of doing my thesis.
Mm-hmm.
Then I had my son, Bill, in 62. And of course we didn't have insurance. Okay,
go on.
So I had Bill, and he wasn't paid for, and we had to get a job. At this point, I'd spoken to a famous electron microscopist called Don Fawcett, who wrote all these famous books.
Mm-hmm.
And he's in Boston, and my husband had a postdoc at Harvard. So I'd arranged to work for him.
Okay.
So we arrive in Boston with this unpaid-for kid.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to see Dr. Foss, and he said, I thought I was coming in early September. We didn't arrive till mid-September, you know, with our literally house on our back kind of thing. And he hired someone, and so I didn't have a job. And I was stuck there in Boston with, you know, at those days, postdocs, if I told you how little they paid, you'd probably cry. They paid next to nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to find a job where I could get a proper salary. So I started hunting for a job, and the only one that paid well was as a histologist at Harvard, where I would work in this dank basement for a guy by the name of Hans Königsberg. I'm not implying he was a Nazi, but I didn't feel real good about him.
Okay.
And it was dank, but you know, I had this skill. I used to be a teaching assistant in histology, so I knew how to do all of this.
Okay.
And it paid the best.
Okay.
So I had, that was like the middle of the week, and then,
is that the Cancer Research Institute in Boston?
Well, no, that happened. And then I just felt that, you know, life, I'd been let down, and I was so miserable, but I had to work and pay for Bill. And so I had two more days alone with my baby, and it was so hard. He was so adorable to give, you know, to leave him to go to work for Von Königsberg. All these negative feelings, right?
Yes.
And then I get a call from Shields Warren at the Cancer Research Institute.
Okay.
That the person who was heading a project there was leaving, and would I be interested? Oh, was I interested? And they were just starting out in cytogenetics then.
Okay.
This was really the beginning of cytogenetics. So I got the job. And it turned out, and I won't name my predecessor, he got a job at Fordham, and he thought he was the cat's pajamas. But on this project, he had done very poorly. I mean, we were supposed to report this thing in several months to the American College of Pathology, huge meeting, 5,000 people. And so I had to work with this data. This data didn't make sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I went and worked it myself, and I realized that he had completely missed all of the votes because none of what he found made sense. So I had to redo everything.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was supposed to come up, so we go over the final. So I took some cells and irradiated them, and they had an x-ray machine. And then I told him to look at those cells and say, what do you see?
Uh-huh.
And he said, oh, I see 46 chromosomes. And I said, look carefully, I can still remember that. And finally, I said, this cell has three dicentrics, which is what happens when you radiate, the ends sort of stick together.
Okay.
And then when the cells try to divide, they break, and the chromosomes, it breaks, and then this causes the cell to die, and that's how radiation therapy works.
Okay.
Anyway, so he couldn't even see a dicentric, which was what this was all about.
Okay, so he was totally unqualified.
Right, totally unqualified,
okay.
And I must say they doubled my salary in the first year and
really?
Allowed me to take all the vacations I wanted.
That's very nice, so
yeah.
You were well recognized for your
yeah,
work.
Yeah, I really, Dr. Warren was a prince, you know. He had many residents all over the world, and he was really internationally known for his ability in radiation biology.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know how much of some of his personal stuff, well, anyway, you can figure out what to use. So, I worked there, and in fact, I used the data for my dissertation,
okay.
Which was on chromosome damage in lymphocytes of patients undergoing radiation therapy.
Okay.
Unfortunately, they spelled it human lymphocytes. It came out hymen lymphocytes, so it was very well read. I don't know how that happened, and they indexed it.
Interesting. So what index had it misspelled?
Well, I don't know, at the library at the university.
Oh.
I found out later. It was hysterical. Anyway, in fact, I forgot to tell you, my master's thesis was on the racial factor in disease.
Mm-hmm.
So already I was showing a lot of interest in biology and
yeah.
disease variation, sickle
yeah.
cell anemia, all the things that were different cultures.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so I wrote my thesis while after we left, my husband had a job at Virginia teaching, and that's where I had my second daughter.
Okay.
And I mean my third child, my first daughter actually. And when I was in the hospital, this guy comes up to me and says, "You got to work for me. You got to work for me." I said, "Well, you know, I had really bad vibes about him."
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Oh no, that's all right. I just want to stay home a little bit, this and that." "Oh no, please work for me." I didn't know he carried on. Then the dean of the medical school comes in. "You got to work for Professor."
Really?
I mean, I don't know if he wanted his name or not.
I
can give it to you, but
oh, sure.
You know, you can use discretion. Looney, that was his name, William Looney.
Why was he so interested in your skills?
Well, I didn't know. So it took me a while. So I went to work for him, but he didn't use me for what I'd been trained in cytogenetics. I was studying rats and slides, and, you know, I was working, but it was not work to my taste. It was half time because also I had to take it. Because of the fact that I was now in biological sciences, even though I passed out of everything in the social science, I had to take physics.
Okay.
So I was taking physics.
This is to satisfy the PhD requirement.
That's right, exactly.
Okay.
I was the only female in the class because at that time Virginia was all male.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes, and they were all babies. I mean, pipsqueaks, they'd come in there. They had their answers written up from the fraternity house before they got to class, and I'm working my tail off.
What was it like to be the only woman in a class?
Well, that didn't bother me as much as the fact that they were so young.
Hmm.
And here I am, a mother of three, worrying about important things and having, you know, But I had to take it, and it wasn't a problem. As soon as I graduated from physics, I got my degree.
Okay.
So I was working on my thesis and on physics and working half-time. And after about a year of that, I said to him, you know, Dr. Looney, this is not using my skills at all. And somebody else was starting a cytogenetics laboratory, and he asked me to work for him. Well, this is my field, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I said, I'm going to leave you and work for the other person. And then he says, if you do, your husband will never get another job, and you'll never get a job. You'll be blackballed. You can't leave me. So I said, this is still, last time I looked, this was still America. It's a free country. No, you can't leave me. I mean,
why was
finally
he?
I gave him, I said, I'm going to stay 1 month, and then I'm going. Well, it turned out he got a grant from the AEC, which was then the Atomic Energy Commission, which is now the Department of Energy,
mm-hmm.
to support my work.
Oh, and he was using the money
And he
himself?
Was using that money to hire two other people and me.
Oh, okay.
So my salary was funding his lab assistants.
What did you do when you found that out?
Well, what am I going to do? I'm not going to report him or anything, you know. But then at least I realized that he wasn't as loony as I thought he was. Anyway, so then I worked there for a while. Then we went back to, my husband went back to Harvard for half a year.
Okay.
I finished off my thesis. And then we, where did he go then? It's 1964.
Stanford?
Oh, yeah, then he went to Stanford. Then he went, he was nominated to the, the Advanced Institute for Studies in Social Sciences that was in Palo Alto, associated with Stanford,
okay.
where you sit there and contemplate your neighbor for a year and write great things and meet with great scholars.
What was his area?
He was in history, in intellectual, Chinese intellectual history.
Okay.
But as it's, you know, it's just a question of who you know, too. Anyway, so he ended up there, and I ended up with three kids in another city, so I had to find a job. And I found a very good postdoc working in the Department of Medicine,
mm-hmm.
because now I really did have a skill that most people wanted. And I worked there for 2 years.
Okay.
And let's see. Oh, he got a job teaching for one of those years at Berkeley. And then we were going to go to Santa Cruz. He had a job, I had a job. But that was when Governor Reagan was in charge of the budget. So he cut back everybody's teaching budget, so one of the jobs got wiped out.
Okay.
So at that point, we were already putting a down payment on a house even.
Okay.
At that, and my kids would have grown up to be beach bums, right? So at that point, he got an offer from Wisconsin.
Okay.
And so I came down, and Dr. Inhorn had just started a small cytogenetics lab here, one half, you know, one person.
Okay.
And they actually were the first to describe certain anomalies like trisomy 13.
Okay.
And so he hired, and I did interview with zoology, but I noticed that after all those years, they just had this one female, Nellie, whatever,
Milstead.
Yeah, who
yes.
was still an instructor, and I said, this is not my cup of tea.
Okay.
So I interviewed with Dr. Inhorn, and he sounded, and he was what he sounded like. At least I learned to recognize loonies. So I started working here.
He was not a loony.
No, he wasn't. He was a good man, right?
Okay. Actually, I've got one quick question. Just about, you've talked now about holding several positions, and in every case, you moved to a new city because of what your husband
was
doing.
Yes, right.
I mean, how supportive was your husband of your career?
Not very.
Did he want you to abandon graduate work?
No, he didn't mind that I went to school. He felt he was being very benevolent.
Okay, but he certainly, the assumption was that you should follow him. He would never
follow
you. Of
course, as long as the house was clean and the food was on the table, he was going to allow me to go to school.
Okay. Okay.
But he felt fairly benevolent that he was allowing me to do that.
Really? Okay.
I still think he, you know, it. Anyway, so I graduated and I started working. And when we got here, my daughter was 4 and my son was 6 and my oldest son was 16.
Mm-hmm.
My daughter was just all this moving around. I hired someone to come in to stay with her.
Okay.
For a year and just turned over my salary in total. It was a break even situation.
So you weren't making money then. You wanted to work out of interest then.
I was being paid, but I made the same amount that I paid my babysitter.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah, but you have to, you know, this is one of the dangers. When you get out of your field too long, then people don't take you seriously.
Okay.
And this is, I think, one of the biggest problems women face. You know, if you kill yourself, they'll take you seriously, but then you kill yourself. And if you don't, they don't take you seriously.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. So I did, I worked, and it was, and I really enjoyed working. I must tell you that in the early days, I really felt it was a privilege to be able to work and even get paid for what I would enjoy doing so much.
Well, I know that some women would come with their husbands to universities, and I don't know if this is true about UW, but they would get honorary positions, unpaid
positions.
Not
in those days. In those days, things were very different. There were very few women on the staff.
Okay.
I was hired as an instructor.
Okay.
For 2 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you what it was like. I mean, how many women there were and what types of positions
virtually
they had.
Virtually none. You know, there were very few women. Anyway, I became interested, of course, in affirmative action.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, I think in 1973, although I could get the dates exactly, I was on the affirmative action committee.
Yes,
the
Senate
I'm going
to be
committee.
Asking you
right,
about that
right.
a bit later.
And at that time, we were interviewing different departments to find out why they had no females.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly enough, genetics that was graduating, almost 50% females, had no females on their staff. And it was appalling. So, and I mean, engineering, chemistry, you should see some of credit. And there were very few women faculty.
Okay.
Education and so forth, and some of the, you know, maybe English. But in the hard sciences, it was really very upsetting that they couldn't find a woman anywhere.
Okay.
And you know the situation in after all those years in zoology that has over 50% women. And Nellie was their most popular teacher yet.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I can't remember. You probably know the exact years, but I think it was in 1980 or so. Somebody, a woman died. And she left money for the UW to hire a woman professor in history with the stipulation, Gerda Lerner took that job, by the way.
Oh, would you mean Ruth Blyer? She died.
No, it wasn't Ruth.
Later.
Ruth died much later, but this woman was at Racine or somewhere else.
Okay, I don't know who it is.
Yeah, and she left this fund, and the stipulation was that whoever was hired could not be asked to make coffee.
Really? And so Gerda Lerner was
Gerda
given that
Lerner
position.
Took the job, right?
Is that what brought her to UW?
Exactly.
Okay.
It was that named professorship.
Okay.
Okay.
Wow. So a lot
but
of
But this was actually a few years later, right?
Okay. But in the early 70s then, a lot of women were making coffee, it
yeah,
sounds
exactly.
like.
You got it.
Okay.
Right, right. And so it was, and also because of the lack of child care, people were really screwed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they don't know now how hard it was. And the other thing is, your kids, they didn't have a school lunch program in Madison.
Okay.
And your kids that didn't, you know, the working moms, it was really embarrassing that your kids had to stay home while the others went home for lunch. And they had to stay at school. And the teachers resented having to watch these kids
okay.
at lunchtime. This wasn't part of their job.
Okay.
So, I don't know if I mentioned this last time, so they had this rule that as long as it wasn't too cold out, they'd have to go outside and play. They'd eat their little sack lunches and go outside and play in the backyard. And one day, I come home and my daughter was telling me, she said, we had to go outside and play. Both. She said, and it was so cold. Well, there's a wind chill of 20 below, you know, although it was that cold, but the wind chill was
yeah.
terrible. And she said, and we all piled on top of each other, and we kept warm.
Oh, my goodness. So was that really difficult for you then, hearing about?
Difficult? I turned that program upside down.
Oh.
I was down at the school before, you know, the smoke cleared, and they changed their policy.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But that was a personal one. But, you know, I mean, certain things like that, it just, you know, and there were, and as I said, eventually, the Child Care Committee did four things. We caused the city to institute a lunch program.
Okay.
The daycare program was instituted by the city.
Uh-huh.
We started Bernie's Place.
Okay.
And another, and One of the other things we did was we wanted to organize the mothers at Eagle Heights. And we never did get to what I wanted, which was having the time off so they could take upgrading courses on child care.
Okay. Now, what years was the daycare committee active?
I think it was 1972 to, you know, 76 or 74. It was, or 70 to 74, something like that.
So it's definitely one of the early issues.
Oh, yes. And the other one who was on that committee then was Mary Rouse.
Okay.
So you'll probably get this from her, too.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And the committee is active again now. I'm having, you know, still there.
Okay.
And raising money for upgrading facilities because daycare is so expensive. And it, and the guilt of leaving your child in an inferior situation is unbelievable.
Well, the Chronicle for Higher Education had an article just 4 days ago about women and how women with children are much less likely to get tenure than women without children, but men with children are more likely to get tenure.
That's right. They didn't hold it against them a bit. And, you know, and it, as I say, it's so traumatic to leave your cute little ones and they're crying and you have to go to work and et cetera. So, you know.
So did you ever think about, I mean, was there pressure on you from, I don't know, your husband or friends or other people?
Oh, my mother thought I was, you know, that it was very unkind to my children that I would consider. But, you know, I feel that if you have an ability, you should use it. And actually, my children turned out better than most, you know, because all the time I spent with them was quality time.
Yeah.
Because when I wasn't with them, I had so much guilt, I could hardly wait to go do wonderful things, whereas everybody else's kids were wandering around the block and living in my house. So I don't think it was a detriment at all.
Okay. Okay. Now, can you just talk about some of the other obstacles apart from child care that women face? I mean, I was wondering,
for example... Well, we didn't have any buddy systems, you know, where you go out for beer afterwards and men give you help. I mean, you're really all by yourself.
So no mentoring?
No mentoring. God, who knew what that was?
Okay.
You know, so after 5 years, I got put up for tenure. I didn't make it the first round, but I did the next one. But, you know, if with mentoring, you know, you don't go through this.
Okay. Actually, could you talk a little bit about your tenure? What the expectations were and why?
Well, you know, the expectations were based as they are now, actually. People think it was a whole lot easier. But, you know, you still had to have grant support, which I did, and you still have to teach. And you still, and in the medical school, most people will form some kind of clinical service, and I was running the cytogenetics lab.
Okay.
And that was my clinical service. So I did those three.
Okay, and why do you think then you were turned down the first time?
Oh, my, I didn't have enough publications, probably.
Okay. But then the second time
yeah,
you went
I did,
through.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, prior to the mid...
It may be that I was a woman. I have no idea.
Okay.
Because when I went up a professor, nobody said anything. I had no mentoring. And many years passed. You know, there was a long lag between becoming a professor and associate professor.
Okay.
And I never would have even thought of being put up. Nobody suggested I'd be put up. And then somebody in my department wanted to be put up. And when I looked at his resume or CV and compared to mine, I said, this is ridiculous. I demand to be put up.
Okay, so this was being put up for tenure. You were at
no, I, the tenure I had, it was for a full professor.
Okay, moving from associate
right,
to full
right,
professor.
Right.
Okay. Okay.
But anyway, but tenure, so I made that in the 7 years exactly.
Okay, actually, I never even asked you how you went from being, because you started out as a lecturer and then you switched.
Right, after 2 years as an instructor, and after 2 years they made me assistant professor. I guess that was the longest you could be an instructor.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Because I know a lot of people were hired at that time as instructors or lecturers, and some of them were then moved to tenure track positions in some way.
Right. No, it was tenure track when I took it.
Okay.
That was the understanding.
Okay, I see. Okay. Now, before the mid-1970s, were there any channels through which women could complain about discrimination if they felt they had been discriminated against?
No.
No.
That, you know, just being irrational.
Okay.
Not to my knowledge, you know. The university really did take, you know, put money. They made Serena Pondrum position on women.
Okay.
And then the committee started at that point.
But that was all in the early 70s when things started.
Yes, it was. Before that, it was the Pitts.
Okay. Do you know of any woman who experienced discrimination and tried to do something about it?
Miriam Namenworth, I can name two.
Okay.
And you know what happened to her.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one is, and I gave you her name before.
Oh, Teresa Duello.
Teresa Duello. Now, Teresa, you know, I mean, she's still doing good work. But she was like a meteor before they beat her down.
Okay. Okay, and those are both later examples, because Mary Nibbernworth is in the 70s, and Teresa Dwella was late 80s, early 90s?
No, it was before then.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's just that case went on for a long time.
Okay. Okay. Well, maybe just we could return to the early 70s, and I was wondering if you could talk about the impact of the women's movement on campus, just if there were...
Well, it was so wonderful to meet other women. I mean, that's when we met Ruth Blyer and all those people. And to feel like you're a member of a group, you know, you're not alone and floating loose.
So how did that start? I mean, how did women come together?
You know, I can't remember how it started at the point.
Were you all reading the same books or listening to the same
speakers?
Well,
at some point, somebody must have, I can't remember who started it. But, you know, the fact that there were other women on campus, whether we started a group, but we did start a group, and I don't know who started it.
There's the Association for Women, Association of Women Faculty.
Yeah,
is that what you're thinking of?
Yeah, right.
Okay.
And then we would meet together and compare problems and so forth.
Okay. What sorts of things were you talking about? Were you reading together or
No,
reading
no, we
speakers?
Were just talking about, no, we were just talking about local problems, you know, dealing with our colleagues and so forth. I was also, for temporarily, I joined this group for, what was it? It was the science students, women's...
Sigma Delta Epsilon?
Yeah, right. And they had speakers, since you mentioned speakers.
Mm-hmm.
And they had very good speakers, but I asked to be head of their education committee, and I said, never again, we have a man speaker here.
Really?
And from then on, we had only women speakers, because how are you going to get people to recognize what they can do unless you get prominent women to speak?
Okay. Okay, that makes sense.
The only man that ever spoke before that group was Shane, as chancellor, when he was chancellor.
Really?
Yeah.
Now, what kind of role did Sigma Delta Epsilon serve on campus?
Well, I think they did get the... I think I met a lot of the women there, too.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
in fact, maybe that's where we first met. I can't... You know, it was a long time ago.
Okay, so it was an important way of networking then.
Yeah, it was.
Women.
It was. But as I said, I thought it was appalling that their education was limited to men speakers of note.
And what sorts of issues did you talk about then? Problems that you were all facing or that people would come up with?
You know, I really can't remember the details. Because there really was a double standard, and you immediately forget, you know, past pains. But, I mean, if you were to write something, it wouldn't be as good as if a man's name was on it, and that kind of thing. Everything was interpreted differently. In fact, they did an article in Science, and I can't remember when, where they had two CVs, and
mm-hmm.
they were applying for jobs, and they sent them to different universities with men's and women's names, and always the man got the job. And the women, they had all kinds of problems with the same resume.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and that's the way it was. I mean,
okay.
We had a much higher, how shall I say, we had to be twice as good and work twice as hard.
Okay, higher standards.
Yeah, and that's why I think I had this extra year on my tenure. I don't think that much changed, but it was just to make the point that this is the way it is.
Okay. Now, I was wondering about the impact of federal legislation, because I know in 1972 there's the Equal Employment Opportunities Act and Title IX. What impact did they have on the university?
That's why all those committees were started.
Okay. So these acts may force the university to start up committees?
Absolutely.
What committees did they start up? Or
administrative positions? A Committee on Non-Discrimination and that was the main one, I think. But there were a few other committees, and people were then looking, you know, into acts of discrimination.
Now, do you think that the administrators took this seriously, or did they create these committees because they had to?
I don't really know. I don't know what was in their hearts.
Okay.
But I don't think they would have done it if they didn't have to.
Sure.
You know, you never go out of your way. But they did. They made Serena Pondham the head of the Office of Women.
Okay.
And then they started various committees, and people were supposed to complain. Had a source. Now you had an outlet for complaint.
Okay. And what was the nature of Serena Pondham's job?
She was the, similar to what Bernice Durand is doing. Yeah.
Okay. So I know her title is Associate Vice Chancellor of Diversity
and
Climate.
Right, but at that time they called her head of the Office of Women.
Okay.
And they also hired somebody else who was for affirmative action who was a black.
Okay, okay. Well, maybe we can now talk about the Committee on Non-Discrimination and Affirmative Action in Faculty Appointment, and you chaired this committee from 1974 to 79.
Right.
So to whom did this committee report?
To the Senate.
Okay.
To the University Senate. It was a Senate committee.
And how did you become its chair?
I don't know. You know how they... I guess I didn't say no hard enough.
Had you been involved in any organizations, activities
well,
till then that might have...
You know... the Child Care Committee, and I was working, you know, with, actually, the university was kind of active in that. They were working with 4Cs and other child care groups in the city and so forth, and I would meet with them.
Okay, so perhaps you'd become known because
right,
of those
through the child care, right.
Okay. Okay, and do you know of any of the committee's other members? I know it was a long time ago, but I'm just curious.
You know, I could probably find it. I've got boxes of stuff somewhere.
Oh, well, don't ever throw those boxes out. They should go to the
archives. I know. I have to get them and put them in. Right now, I'll find them because there were so many notices of meetings and
yes,
and in the notices I always had the topics that we were going to discuss, etc. And it's amazing how you there's so much that happens and you so much to forget.
Yes, yes. Well,
and we don't have any way a hard drive. You know, we didn't have computers in those days. We had to Xerox them, a mimeograph them rather.
Yes, yes. So let's see here. Now, what did the committee actually do? What did it recommend?
Okay. What we did was we met with different departments, in fact, just about every department, and had them discuss with us what they were doing to get women.
Okay.
And minorities.
Okay. And how did the departments respond?
Well, we usually met with the chairman. Some of them responded, but, you know, in negative, more or less negative ways.
Okay. They didn't take it seriously.
No. And, you know, because there aren't any out there. Et cetera, et cetera. And then we would give forth the various statistics of how many they graduated. You know, it was very hard for them to accept that women could have equal intelligence.
So what were some of the reasons they gave for not wanting to hire women?
They couldn't find any qualified women.
That was the main reason?
Right.
Okay. Even though statistics showed that there were women with PhDs.
Yeah, but, you know, they just didn't measure up.
And
I wouldn't be surprised if some of their early hires weren't there just to show that.
Really, they would specifically.
I mean, I don't know that, but you know, I'd like to look back and see what the those who didn't last long. If it wasn't that they were, you know, they did this with blacks too in some cases where they would hire somebody that was not very good, so that people recognized that you know they couldn't really make tenure. And,
interesting. I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah, that was always a concern. You know that. That it be a serious hire of somebody who really could make tenure.
Now, were there some departments in which they weren't trying to hire more women? They were doing this
well,
in good
zoology
faith?
Got a few after that, and also Nellie became a full professor the year before she retired.
That's right, yes.
And I think, I don't think genetics even hired one, but Klaus Patow, who was a famous cygeneticist, when he died, his dying wish was that they make his wife a faculty member.
Really?
And which they did.
Okay.
And so she gave a presentation, and she was introduced as their token woman.
Really?
I was livid.
So she was a distinguished scientist who had never been able to
no,
get a
that's right.
Position
she always
before.
She was his technician. She did all the work for him. She worked with him. But she was a woman.
And what was her name?
Eva Thurman.
Okay.
So,
do you know if she's still alive?
She's still alive, but I think she went back to Finland.
Okay.
But I have her book here. Anyway, so Dr. Fox, who also subsequently died of lymphoma, but he was introducing her for the department seminar, and he introduced her as a token woman. And he thought it was joking, but there's some things you just don't joke about.
Yeah.
So I sent him a letter. I should find all these letters. I sent a letter to the chancellor. I sent a letter to Serena. I sent a letter to the head of the division. I sent everybody a letter saying in what bad taste it was. And mm-hmm. I did get back really strong apologies from the chairman of genetics.
Wow. Okay. Okay. So then in the end, did the committee come up with a set of recommendations?
Yeah, well, this is what happened. Then we went through, and some people did hire women, and, you know, it improved slightly.
Mm-hmm.
So then we were supposed to prepare a report for the Senate. And so the university got together all of the statistics for me, and I put them all on the table, and I looked and I said, this is pitiful.
So, they, but I did report what I said, you know, with my editorial comments. Anyway, then I was off the committee.
Because of your report?
Something like that.
Really? Okay.
Well, let's put it this way. A couple days later, they said, I've been here too long.
Really?
Something like that.
Because you were really
critical
it of
was
the university.
Really, I mean, I gave the data they gave me, but it was not good data. I mean, it was better than nothing, but not a whole lot.
Okay.
And so I read off the statistics, made charts, and that didn't come out too good.
Okay. Now, were you making recommendations for how to change this and how to?
Yeah, I said we have to get better, you know, and we did make recommendations in each department, you know, where to look and how to help and.
Okay.
But anyway, so.
But you don't think the Faculty Senate wanted to hear that?
No, the faculty didn't take me off. I'm sure it was somewhere else. I have no idea who did it.
Okay. Okay.
I don't know who, but they decided that I was on 6 years, which is 2 years beyond normal.
Okay, so what happened to the committee after 1979?
Yeah, I don't really know. I don't think they were very active.
Do you know who replaced you?
No. Actually, it'd be very interesting to find out. I have a lot of data on everything before then, but I have no idea what happened after. I never heard from them. Maybe they just banned the committee, thinking that they had solved the problem. In fact, that was perhaps the idea.
They thought that within a space of 4 or 5 years, they would solve
that's
the problem.
That's right. Once they hired enough people, they would have met the federal regulations.
What were the federal regulations?
Well, they were suggesting, you know, that, I mean, with the, you know, Title IX and all that, that you had to have equal access and so on and so forth, and at least look like you were, like it was, you read all those employment things, we are non-discrimination, affirmative action, blah, blah.
So it was not necessarily that every department had to have 50% women, but
no.
That there should be some maybe proportional to the number of graduates?
Yeah, that's all we wanted.
Okay.
You know, and we felt that once women and blacks were in a position of teaching, that the students would change their attitude, you know, and the next generation would come up feeling women could be okay.
Okay. So within these few years, a few hires were made, but
yes.
Not very many.
Not, well, that's right. The university was proud of it. I wasn't.
Okay. Okay.
How to put it that way. They were proud when they gave me the statistics.
I see. Okay.
I didn't think it was all that great given the number of male hires.
Okay. Okay, I understand.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, I was wondering if you could talk about some of the other women on campus who took leadership positions.
Well, they were great, like Ruth Blyer, and you know, a lot of those people left also.
Can you talk a bit about Ruth Blyer? I'm curious to know more about her.
Okay, well, sure, she was, you know, a brilliant, she played the harp.
Really?
And she was in the Department of Anatomy, which was a tough nut. She was a neuroanatomist, and she did really great work, but nobody ever heard that much about women's great work, I will tell you that, and they still don't. Have you noticed how many great women there are in the world?
And she was very involved in activities for women
she
in science.
She was, right, and we were, and she was in that committee, and we all met frequently.
Oh, so she was on the non-discrimination committee,
No,
too.
She was on the ad hoc committee that we had of Association of Women. It wasn't a Senate committee, it was a...
Oh, do you mean the,
right.
What was it called? The Association of University
That's right,
Faculty.
Right,
okay.
Right.
Okay.
Faculty of Women Faculty.
Of Women Faculty.
Right.
Okay. So what kind of
I think there was one of them. Yeah, no, not everybody was in the med school. There weren't that many people in it. You'd think I'd remember their names.
Okay, no, I know it was a long
time
ago.
Yeah,
I heard that she also had an important role as a mentor to other women on campus.
She was. She was a wonderful, she was a real role model and mentoring. And, you know, when you see brilliant women, it's very inspiring. That's what people have to see.
Mm-hmm.
When you grow up and go to school and you just see men, you figure you can't do it.
Well, were there other women on campus who were important leaders?
You know, there were a few, and I just, you know, Serena was, of course, also met with the faculty group.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't remember everybody's name, and it's really, I should go through these old boxes, you know, when they moved me from the second floor to here. I had all that stuff at the ready before. I'll have to find it. I will make that my goal before
sure.
You're done with your book.
Sure. Oh, absolutely. The archives would love to have anything
okay.
That you have.
I do. I would like to get rid of the child care committee. I mean, we have all these minutes and, you know, and I send all kinds of encouraging letters out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's all important stuff
okay,
for historians.
Okay, I'll find it, yeah.
I was wondering, also, in the 70s, what were the other main topics that were of concern to women? And you already mentioned child care. non-discrimination in hiring. I'm wondering, like, things
equal
like...
Equal opportunity, you know, and equal access to tenure.
Okay, so tenure, discrimination when it came to tenure.
Yeah, it really comes to that, you
okay.
know. And we had a few glaring examples, Miriam being one. Brilliant. You know, somebody steals her work and they badmouth her, and there it is.
Okay.
And also, there was always, there still is a double standard. If you're a fat man, they don't hold it against you.
So Marion Abendroth was a large woman?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Could you talk a little bit about her case?
Yeah. But this is something that they're always making these comments about women professors who are obese or, you know, not attractive.
Mm-hmm.
Who says that about a man who's a professor and not attractive?
Mm-hmm.
I always found that was really terrible, that with this talk about double standard. But anyway, you know, she was working in embryology, and she, in fact, I was on a committee at some point that gave her a grant where she was looking at polarity of the embryo and how it knew which was the head and which was the feet kind of thing.
Okay.
And she was just doing really brilliant work. And then she came up for tenure, and they badmouthed her. And they said that her work was trivial, and somebody else literally stole it.
Now, these were members of her...
faculty, of her own department.
Why do you think they badmouthed her?
Because he stole her work, and they didn't want her. And because they were discriminating. It was zoology, wasn't it?
It was zoology, yes.
Yeah, well, what can I say?
Okay.
What more do I have to say?
Okay, so there are a few members of the department who were really after her. And
well, for men, I mean, there are very few women. The women who made it subsequently, you know, ran BioCorps and all that hard stuff that men didn't want to mess with.
Okay. Okay. And so she was ultimately denied tenure, and then she sued the university and
yes,
lost
and
the case.
Yes, and all the women, we pitched in all we could to support her, but she lost the case. She went to Minneapolis.
Okay. Okay.
And that's a great tragedy and a great loss. And then up after her, a few years later, was Teresa,
mm-hmm.
who came here as a shining light head in her university, you know, with such promise. She was so good. She had more grants than any other person in the department. She wrote more papers than anyone in the department. The students liked her better than anyone in the department.
Uh-huh.
And I think they turned her down because she was too good.
Really? Okay. Now, this was the Department of Anatomy that
Anatomy
actually
again,
turned
yeah.
her down? Okay.
Yeah.
And she sued the university and she won, correctly?
But it went on for so long.
Okay.
You know, attorneys drag things out. And the trouble is the university doesn't have to pay. I mean, the professors that are doing this, they get supported.
So she had to pay her legal fees
That's
out of
right.
her own pocket.
That's
okay.
right.
Now, do you know, at the time, if it could be determined that somebody was denied tenure unfairly, could you then reverse the decision, or was there some way of
Well, they did
it?
In a way. I will tell you, they sat in on her courses, and they attributed to her incorrect statements, which she'd never made. That was another dirty trick.
Oh.
Okay. What happened was that she did appeal it, and she was finally given tenure in another department.
Okay.
So she's an associate professor in the Department of OBGYN.
Okay.
Where she's still very active and so forth, but you know, it took a lot out of her and everybody. I mean, these fights take a lot out of you.
And then she sued again a few years later because she felt her salary was too low.
You bet. And that's when they set an overall university-wide salary review because it turned out all the women were getting less than all the men.
Really? Now, what year would this have been, roughly?
It was probably about 1990 or 92, somewhere around there.
And it was all provoked by her case?
I think it was.
Okay.
And then you looked at it, and everybody was way down there. And a lot of women, I mean, you know, even when I was the Affirmative Action Committee, that was another thing we dealt with. My salary was pathetically low. So I went to the director who sets it, and, you know, he says, well, you've got a husband. I mean, shit.
He told you that?
Yeah, you know, and I said, I don't like to make a stink about this, but this is very bad. But anyway, subsequently, the university itself really did reverse a lot of that. They went through and they evaluated people in terms of their publications, years in service, teaching, et cetera, and they came up with what, and they compared the women to the men in the department.
Uh-huh.
And they came up with salary recommendations, which brought my salary up.
Okay, so you were given a raise.
Yeah,
okay.
Right. And a couple of times, really, because of the universities trying to... So I will say the university did do a lot to try to correct it.
Okay. Now, before the late 80s or early 90s, had this been of concern to them? Had you ever been given a raise before?
My raises were pitiful.
Okay.
You know, and I didn't know how pitiful, and it turns out that... the new guys who were hired with master's degrees were able to park close nearby, and I'm parking way the heck out. And I finally complained to the parking office, and they said, well, it's based on your salary.
Really? So yes. The new master students were earning more than you?
Yeah.
Even though you were chief
of
the section?
Right. They were males, though.
So it was in the early 90s when your salary was corrected?
Yeah.
Okay.
It was, you know, they made minor corrections, I believe, through the 80s. But
okay.
The university administration, to their credit, did it.
Now, do you know who was responsible for that, if there was an administrative position?
No, but they did. I don't know who did it, but I do know they appointed a committee, and I can't remember when, and that really went through and evaluated in the medical school all the women's salaries.
Ah, oh, I'd love to learn more about that committee.
I think actually Teresa's case may have provoked it, and Teresa will probably know about it.
Okay.
But what they did is they went and compared you to men and publications and so forth.
Okay.
Now remember, a lot of this is really not fair because who's on a publication? A group of men, right? They get together. So if you're on the outside, it's really a lot harder all the time, too.
And I suppose that sometimes salaries are set based on if you've received outside offers or not.
There you go.
But
and
if women
you can't
are,
if you're a woman, right?
Yeah, you're less likely to receive
That's
them.
Right, exactly. Well, you wouldn't even solicit them.
That's true, if you're tied
That's
down
right.
by family
exactly.
obligations. Now, has sexual harassment, when did sexual harassment begin to be a concern to people?
I don't really know. I mean, so much of that was natural. You hardly knew when it changed. Yeah.
Okay. And how about staff? So your committee seemed to deal only with faculty.
Right.
Was there a point at which staff concerns?
Uh-huh. The entire staff, you know, have you noticed how many scientists that are running this university and PAs and all that? They're women. That was one of the things when I charged my local people. They said, but I hire so many women. Well,
in supporting roles, though.
Yeah,
yes.
Right, exactly. So that was never a problem in terms of the distribution of sexes.
Okay.
And the salaries are set now by law, you know, social service, depending what position you're hired into.
Okay. Okay.
So that, I don't, that's, we're here, we are in social service or whatever, civil service. Now, it's probably more optional when you're dealing with, you know, the academic staff where they can charge any old thing, and I don't know how it works there.
Okay.
But I wouldn't be surprised if women were getting paid a whole lot less than men.
Okay. Well, my mother was secretary at a university, and at some point they did a study, and they found that, I think it was like the male groundskeepers or something
right,
like that.
Right, got more than,
they decided, well, that's actually of equal value than secretaries, so they bumped up all of the secretaries' salaries.
Well, that was great.
I was wondering if they'd done something similar here.
No, I don't know. That would be, within the civil service, it was a gender's.
What changes you've seen in the climate for women in the sciences, and more broadly at the university, since you've come here?
I will tell you that in my own department, both of them, in fact, we have a lot of women now.
Mm-hmm.
In population health sciences, it's probably 50-50.
Really?
Or maybe even better. And that reflects the students and also the quality of the people who are hired.
Mm-hmm.
And in pathology, there are a number of women also.
Okay.
So we are two good departments. I don't know if any other, how many other departments have such a wonderful display.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you know why it is? Is it just that there are more women students in those areas? Or
no,
have
I mean,
those department chairs made more of an effort to recruit
that
women?
That too, right.
Okay.
A little both. Well, it just happened that they were in the right field at the right time, too.
Okay.
I mean, pathology doesn't have as many as population health sciences because that... I mean, another word for that department is public health, and that has always attracted more women.
Okay. Okay. Now, what about just the climate of how men treat women, you know, how you're treated when you walk into a meeting? Do you still encounter discrimination on a regular?
All the time.
Well, what type of discrimination?
Well, if somebody is going to speak, we'll say we're at a small meeting, who are they going to listen to first?
They pick the man.
Even though I may know more a lot about it, they're going to pick the man.
Do you see when they say they're choosing candidates for positions that they're more interested in the male candidates than female candidates?
Well, I can't speak to that because in my department, being that we have more women, or at least as many, we have a very non-discriminatory, in my main in population health sciences.
Uh-huh.
You know, pathology isn't quite as good, and it hasn't been quite as good for women there.
Okay.
It has not been, I mean.
Okay. what sorts of things have happened to women? Just personal comments, or, I mean...
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of things floating around, like when a woman does something good, it's because she's with a man who's doing it for her type thing.
Okay, women not being given credit for their work.
Exactly.
Okay.
Or she slept with the right person, that's how she got to where she is.
Do people say that as a joke, or do they mean it seriously?
I think some men still think it, but they don't say it anymore, at least.
Oh, that's good. Okay. So you think that things have gotten better in terms of numbers, but in terms of sort of interactions with people...
I don't think that's changed at all.
There are still problems.
Right.
Okay.
I mean, in terms of male perceptions of women.
Okay, so the insides of people's minds haven't changed.
Yeah, they're still, it's the same, they still write. Whereas in terms of an outstanding woman, yeah, they'll hire her for their department because she's got a reputation, you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, the mechanisms that are currently in place to deal with discrimination, do you think they're effective?
I don't know exactly what they are now. I've been so busy, I haven't had a chance to pull my head out of the sand.
Okay.
But, you know, what can you do? I mean, basically, if you complain, nobody's going to do anything.
Because it must be very hard to prove.
Yeah, then how do you prove it, that you're not just a... I mean, we'll talk more later. I mean, even when you've got a prima facie case, it's really hard to prove.
Okay. Well, are there any other comments you want to make about women at the university and women in health sciences?
Well, there's a lot of women, there always has been, in health sciences. And this year it turns out there are more women applying to medical school than men. Did you know that?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, which is an interesting thing. But the number at UW has been consistently increasing and the number accepted. So I think that in medical school we're getting very good figures.
Yeah.
And the women are great.
My impression, a lot of my female friends from high school went on to medical school.
Right.
Now, are the numbers as high in research? Or are more women interested in medical school than in research?
That's a good question. I'm just trying to think of what I know. They're probably not quite as high in research, but, you know, they're much higher than they were back in the 70s.
Okay.
You know, women now feel that there's an alternative. I will say that when I was going to school, I had a woman professor.
Really?
And, you know, in comparative anatomy, and I think that's probably one of the things that tells you can do it.
Was that at the University of Chicago?
Chicago, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, she was amazing. I mean, she was such a tough teacher. She told me I was the best student that she ever had and gave me a B+.
Really? Wow, what was her name?
I can't think of it right now. But
And what, did she have tenure there?
I think she did, yeah. But she was a fabulous professor. And, you know, and it was so exciting.
I could probably find out who she is, because there probably wouldn't have been very many women with tenure.
I could probably even look at my transcript, and if they have her name, they probably don't. But she was one woman that I really admired, and there was somebody else in the department, but, you know, as I said, she was very impressive.
Okay, so you think it's really important to have women in leadership roles? And
It is, definitely, because that's how you get over your biases.
Yeah.
I mean, unless you win... You know, if you hire somebody who's an idiot and they prove to be an idiot, it's going to just reinforce your biases. So, you know, you don't want to just hire to get a body in there. You want to get quality, and you can do it if you're willing to pay for it.
Yeah. Okay. Now, I thought I would just ask you briefly about your research and your teaching, if that's okay with you. Could you talk a little bit about your research program, the big questions that you've looked at?
In the past, I was very interested in the effect of environmental toxicants on causing mutations in humans.
Okay.
Things that get into the water supply that people drink and their effect on, you know, cancer and genetic mutations, birth defects, and so forth.
Okay.
So I've been working on that over the years. I mean, you know, your research changes with the time and with what's... And then in the 1990s, I began working on DNA probes, especially relative to this gene in breast cancer.
Okay.
And I put in for a grant in 1992 to the Army, you know, to study this particular gene. And they wrote back, they said, you know, she has a good lab and a good background, this and that, but why would you want to study this dumb gene? Something like that, you know.
Really? Well, yeah. I'm curious about the connection between breast cancer and the Army. Why would the Army
what happened was that there was the women's movement was complaining, saying, put all this money in research, but there's no women, there's, you know, prostate cancer and all. but there's no money in breast cancer research and things affecting women.
Uh-huh.
So they decided they would make one less B-27 bomber, which led to so many million dollars being available, and that's how the Army breast cancer is still here.
Really? So the Army, they deliberately chose to study breast cancer?
Right. They didn't chose it. They call it the Army Breast Cancer Grant because it's the cost of their B-29 or whatever.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, that released so much money.
And so you were given part of this grant?
No, I wasn't. I was turned down because, you know, they wanted to study and this gene that I said is associated with aggressive breast cancer and we want to study it, but they didn't think that was relevant. Well, now, of course, this gene turns out to have an antibody to it, and they're curing women with this previously lethal form of breast cancer because Genentech made a monoclonal antibody to the product of this gene.
Mm-hmm.
So it turned out to be really, really important, and we do a lot of clinical diagnosis of this because it can guide treatment.
Okay. Now, did you carry on this line of research, or did you have to stop
yes.
it because of lack of funding?
No. I mean, one of the things that this, you know, we generated some money, and a lot of my research is clinical. And actually, I did get then support from a private company that was doing, was making probes.
Okay.
And they needed to do an FDA research, to get their probes accepted to show that they worked and all.
Okay, so that's, and are you currently working on the breast cancer project?
I'm still working on it, but from a different angle now.
Okay.
So over the years, one of the things I'm trying to eliminate is, you know, In 1895, Halstead, roundabout there, determined that breast cancer cells spread via the lymphatics.
Uh-huh.
And that's what led to the Halstead radical mastectomy, where they removed all your lymph nodes, and the before and after, the muscles, and you know. It's very deforming, and they did that for about 50 years, and then the doctor said, wait a little minute, that we don't have to do anything. You know, it's not necessarily that, so they did the modified mastectomy, which you've heard, modified radical.
Okay.
Which they just took the breast and all the lymph nodes on the arm.
Okay.
Then science marches along and they say, oh, we really don't have to take all the lymph nodes. Let's just take the sentinel lymph node, which, by the way, is the current mode of practice.
Okay.
So what they do is they shoot a dye to see which one is feeding the breast cancer. So if the lymph node has cancer cells, then they figure it's a systemic disease and they treat you aggressively.
Okay.
And if it isn't, and however, if you look at statistics, none of this matters a whole lot. What matters is the genetic background of the cancer itself. Lymph nodes drain your breast, and if you left them alone, nothing would happen. It's just like a garbage dump, you know?
Really? Okay.
Once in a while, they'll grow, and at that point, you remove them. But they don't grow from there. They grow from your blood supply.
Okay.
But the irony is how they hung on to this myth. First, they said radical no count, then modified radical, and then now it's down to sentinel lymph nodes. Well, if it doesn't travel that way, why the heck are they messing with lymph nodes?
Okay.
Because this is where all the pain and discomfort is associated with, because the breast removal, because you've got a lot of blood vessels there and nerves that are very hard not to damage, and that's why all these reach for recoveries are not because of the breast, but because of lymph node removal.
Really? Yeah. Okay.
And besides, your lymph nodes are put there for purpose.
What purpose they?
They drain. They help get rid of, you know, antibodies and things that you don't need in your system. So why, tamper with Mother Nature?
Okay, so your work has been connected with trying to.
Yeah, so I'm trying. My point is to prove that one, if you do the genetic of the cancer itself, maybe you'll find out who's going to be bad and not bad. And if it's not bad, you just do radiation or minimal surgery. And if it's bad, you do chemo based on the genetic constitution of the cancer and leave the lymph nodes alone, unless they're big. If they're big, you can take them out because then you can find them easily.
Okay. So in some ways, this might be an example of where, when it was men making all the decisions, just thought, well, take it all out.
And that's right. And what does it matter? That's right. So here's a good example. I say if it was wrong to do a radical, why, and a modified radical wasn't so good, why is it right to do a... And this is how they used to find out if a cancer spread, and then they think it's systemic if it's in your lymph node.
Okay.
But if you look at the overall statistics, there isn't a whole lot of difference whether they found it there or not. And the really dangerous cancers spread via the internal blood supply.
Okay.
And those are the ones you want to worry about. Because the blood supply, you know, is exchanged where the lymph node stays put.
Okay.
So that's one of the things that I'm hoping to work on.
Okay, so you're hoping to encourage the medical profession to perform less invasive surgery.
And instead, all you have to do is make a paraffin section, a slice of the tumor, which can be done at any point.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to go back to the woman at all. It's totally non-invasive.
Okay.
And you look at the slide, and then you decide.
Okay.
And you don't go around poking holes.
And has this been adopted yet, or is
no? It hasn't. I'm still a lonely woman, but some people are trying to listen.
Okay.
But the main thing is to find enough genetic markers in the tumor itself, so that we can make a prognostic determination. Now, my ability to do research recently has been very curtailed by an increased clinical load.
Okay. Okay. Now, clinical load, you mean teaching students?
Well, I wish it would. I always teach whenever I can, but by clinical load, I mean this is a clinical laboratory where we do diagnostic testing for the state.
Okay.
And for hospitals all over the country in some cases.
So this means people approaching you and saying, please spend your time on this.
They send us case and we have to, and we get paid for it. It's a clinical, the insurance pays.
Okay, I see.
Yeah, so that's why I have a little slush money there for research too. And I mean, 1 year I wrote 20 grants, but right now if I just had the time, I could do the research.
And what types of jobs do you do for the state then?
Well, what we do is we test like prenatal. It's not really a state. It's clinics and hospitals throughout the state.
Okay.
Women who are pregnant and at risk for having an abnormal baby, they'll give us amniotic fluid to grow.
Okay.
And or earlier, they can do chorionic villus biopsies up to about 11 weeks.
Okay.
Yeah, and then birth defects to figure out what's wrong with the kid.
Okay.
And cancer, we do a lot of that, and leukemia. Now, since we've been doing chromosome studies in leukemia, leukemia was previously a sentence of death, and now well over half of them are curable.
Okay. Now, do the hospitals and clinics not have these facilities themselves?
No, this is very specialized.
Okay. Okay. So what do you think your most important contribution to your field has been, or your favorite publication?
Boy, that's really tough. Well, in keeping with my philosophy of being non-invasive, many years ago I felt that we could just culture the cells in your peripheral blood and not always have to keep puncturing people's bone marrow.
Mm-hmm.
So I did a long time ago calls, on the use of peripheral blood versus bone marrow in diagnosing leukemia, and that's the one that got me tenure, actually.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. Now, since then, I've written a lot of important, I know, papers, some of them more important than others, and I should go down the list. But, and also we succeeded in getting the atrazine limit limited.
What do you mean by that?
They used to put it all over the place, and then we showed that atrazine could cause genetic damage if it's in the water supply and ingested and so forth.
No, atrazine, what chemical,
it's
used for?
It's a herbicide.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, and that was earlier, that was more in the 70s.
Well, they're
then?
Still using it. I mean, it's the most common, but they did lower the acceptable limits.
Ah, okay, but your
and
research...
And PCBs, my research did involve that, and then, the farmers were writing me dirty letters, but, just cut their uses in half. And the amount of PCBs that were allowed to be discharged into the environment, we showed certain ones were toxic and so on.
Okay, so, and that was in the 70s that you were focusing on that?
No, actually, I did that in the 80s.
Okay.
Yeah.
And now, is that still a hot topic now, or did people lose interest in...
No, actually, I'm still interested in it, but I just got so busy, and then I got carried away with this new technology. Hopefully, I'll get back to that.
Okay.
Yeah, in fact, I've got some students who want to work with me, and, I give students projects that they can carry through from beginning to end,
mm-hmm.
and so I will find some toxicant that they can see if it's mutagenic and carry it through.
Okay, okay.
Actually, my best work I never even published.
What was that?
I wanted to show if we could cause less damage in cells undergoing radiation.
Mm-hmm.
So we took some naked lymphocytes and we over the gamma thing, beneath the ground, and we irradiated them at 50, 100, 200, 400 watts.
Okay.
And then in some of them we put vitamin E, and some we put superoxide dismutase. And before radiation, 6 minutes after or 20 minutes later. And we found that the vitamin E, but not the superoxide, significantly cut the damage.
Really?
And since then, I've been taking vitamin E.
Would you recommend that everyone
Absolutely.
Take?
Absolutely. You don't know what's out there in the environment that can hurt you.
Now that sounds a little bit similar to your PhD dissertation. Was
that's
that
true.
All?
Well, that's when we found out that when you underwent radiation therapy, you know, that all the cells in your body were getting hit because lymphocytes are passing through.
Okay.
So it might really, and in fact, it does carry over because you can protect your normal cells by taking vitamin E if you're undergoing radiation therapy.
But it's not standard practice now to have all
convince,
patients?
You can't convince radiologists that anything like health foods or vitamins are going to make a difference. And some of them do it routinely, mm-hmm. and others will fight you.
Really?
Yeah. We did it with, then we tried it with chemotherapy and had the same result.
Huh. That is very good to know, yeah. the number of people who have to go through
of
something
like that. Of course, yeah. Vitamin C and vitamin E, you need C, but you can't put that in tissue culture because then your cells will stop dividing and they'll make collagen.
Oh, okay.
Right.
Is vitamin E one of the antioxidants?
Yes.
Okay.
And it sits in your cell membrane, and since radiation damage is due to free radicals that go bouncing through your system, if they can't get in because there's a vitamin E at the door, it causes less damage.
Well, I think I might go out and buy some
yeah,
vitamin E.
Right. No, I've been taking it ever since, yeah. I mean, we really did it to test superoxide dismutase, which is supposed to be the most powerful free radical inhibitor there is.
Okay.
And guess what? It turned out, and under the circumstances of our experiment, to actually cause more damage. And I always like to use a positive and negative control. So the vitamin E is my positive control, just to put in something to the same concentration.
Yeah. So did you try to publish this, or was it not?
Actually, I just got so busy, I never published it, but several students got Westinghouses on it doing this research.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, maybe now I can ask you a bit about your teaching, just how much teaching you've done.
Well, I don't teach that much. I've never turned down an offer to teach, but, you know, why would they use me when they can use a man? Well, no.
You really feel that?
Well, to some extent, I don't think they think of asking you, except nobody. I taught in the department when it was preventive medicine. We had a course, Health and Modern Life, and I was sort of in charge of that, and everybody taught their courses, and I taught on, heredity and genetics, I'm sorry, heredity and environment mm-hmm. in birth defects and also in cancer.
Okay.
So I did a lot of that, and I used to speak actually to American Dietetic Association, to the Wisconsin Dietetic Association and so forth on the role of diet and cancer.
Okay.
And that was in 1976, and it took till 1990 till the American Cancer Society started making those recommendations.
Really?
Yeah.
In the 70s, they didn't believe there was a connection?
All the people in the Dietetic Association believed me, and wherever I spoke, they believed me, and the students believed me, but the Cancer Society didn't promote it until 1990 when they found out the role of fat and protein and so forth.
Okay. So I have another question for you related to your teaching. You taught Ways of Knowing Biology.
Right.
Can you talk about that course
well,
a bit?
Well, in the first year, I was a facilitator of their discussion sections where they would discuss such things as genetically engineered foods.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and the what kind of herbicides should be available. And we picked really cosmic topics, and then the kids would discuss it and get a chance to think. We'd give them a little reading.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of interesting, but the kids weren't highly motivated there. So in the second, year, we just had more targeted discussions. And in that year, I did a section on cancer
mm-hmm.
with three lectures, one on cancer etiology, diagnosis, and treatment.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody else did treatment. I just did how you know it, you know. So, and they were very receptive. They had very sophisticated answers here. You know, I asked a question like somebody has, it was genetics, environment, and cancer. So
mm-hmm.
somebody has a grandmother with breast cancer, does she have a genetic risk? And I asked all these questions, and he said, if not, why, and if why,
yeah.
you know. So I said, what if her grandmother, you know, a 70-year-old grandmother, what is her genetic risk? And then, you know, like, what if it's her 50-year-old mother? What is a genetic risk? And what if her sister's got it? What?
Okay.
And stuff like that, and, you know, to make them think about the different...
Okay.
And they really had very, very exciting answers.
So can you talk a little bit about that general course, the ways
yeah,
of knowing
the course is wonderful. They dealt with many very different topics, and I can pull out and show you the topics because I've got them.
Now, is this a first-year course for freshmen, or is it for more
it's
senior
actually,
students?
It's actually, it's for freshmen, or, you know, or it's not for senior, and didn't even give credit before, and people just took it.
Okay.
It's an introduction to biology, and you just sort of get a how shall I say, a stew, a little bit of everything. We had one on, one segment was like on corn and how they cultivate it and change it over the years.
Okay.
And it was all very exciting.
So it's a chance for a lot of fields to just
give
students an introduction.
That's right, exactly.
Okay.
But that was the first year. And the second year, they arranged it so you dealt with, like, one was cancer, so we'd have three lectures on cancer and then so on.
Okay, more focused.
Yeah,
topics.
More focused, right.
Okay, okay. Well, I was also wondering about your service activities. Are there any other service activities that you'd like to mention?
Well, aside from right now being an interviewee for medical school applicants.
Oh, how do you enjoy that position?
I really enjoyed it. You know, in this day of cynicism in medicine, where people, it's a business and all that, it's so wonderful to see these students who are so full of energy and desire and even knowing the problems in modern health delivery. Are still interested in medicine.
I know that medicine attracts a very high caliber of student these days.
Right. Oh, you know, it's just so, and I just met with one today who was so inspiring, I almost couldn't give him up, but. No, here's somebody whose parents were Mexican immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
He went to the University of Chicago, and now he's applying to, and then he took off 2 years to work in a health center to help indigent people fill out forms and walk them through the maze.
Mm-hmm.
And now he's applying to medical school.
So you want to make sure he gets accepted?
Oh, God, yes. And he's very bright and articulate. So it's inspiring when you meet people like that.
And it's a chance for you to connect with students.
It does. I just love it. Yeah, I really do relate to most of them, but this one more than any because he was born where I was born. He went to the same school, and he had some of the same challenges.
Yeah, yeah. And what other service activities have you done?
I have to eat. Who knows, I forget. You know, I was on the medical school committee, which is very time consuming because, you know, just 8 to 20 hours a week just reading applications.
Oh, so this is for applicants to
medical
school.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
And now we just do, now all I do is interview
okay.
a couple times a week.
Okay.
And then non-discrimination, American Cancer Society, I even forgot the daycare thing. Oh, well. I do participate in whenever there's a thing for women and girls.
Okay.
On why they shouldn't be scared. I mean, I was scared of going into science, and you see, I fell in by the back door. Not that I regret anything I studied.
Mm-hmm.
My daughter was afraid of going into science, the same token. And then she discovered computers and got so excited that she had to go through all those top math courses. She
mm-hmm.
became a computer engineer. But the point is, she's very good at what she does, and women can do it.
Yeah, yeah.
But you do tend to get frightened. I mean, when she went through that calculus sequence, I thought I'd kill myself. You know, you'd have to walk on eggs.
And what age are the girls that you often see?
Well, most of them like 16, 17-year-olds in the high schools, and then we visit with their teachers who are turned down and then bring it back, and I give them websites and things so they
okay.
can continue it.
So they're at the stage of thinking about what they want to major
That's
in.
Right, exactly.
So that is a crucial stage.
And in fact, 2 days ago, we did a group discussion in front of the UW undergraduate genetics group,
mm-hmm.
club or whatever, and they had more students in there than my entire graduate school.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, there must have been 60 or 70 people, and they're all studying genetics.
Very good.
it was mind-boggling. I was on the Senate for 10 years.
Now, is that the university Senate
yeah.
or medical school?
Yeah.
What does the Senate do? What issues
Well, they
does it
come, they
face
deal with?
With
problems of should they do this, should they approve that, or, you know, how much. They'll bring up questions. But the main point, it was sort of boring because a lot of people just talk to hear themselves talk. I will say this is a big problem with meetings. You know, people, if you have something to say, you should say it within 3 minutes and then let us get on with it.
So you don't remember any particular issues that came up?
I don't, but if you look at them now, there's the same kind of thing again about. I mean, I remember when we were there, that was when Shalala was. Chancellor,
mm-hmm.
Was the issue of dropping sports.
Oh.
Because of the budget being so limited. They dropped the best sports. We had the top gymnastics team, and they dropped it. Oh, it was heartbreaking. And they dropped baseball. And they just concentrated on the money-making things. Disgusting.
Yeah.
The whole faculty was against it, and it didn't matter.
Mm. Could you comment on Donna Shalala? I'm
yeah.
wondering if she had any impact on the university and in trying to get more women into
no.
science. No.
No.
Not at either the student level or the faculty level?
Not to my knowledge.
Okay.
Basically, I was so excited when we were getting a woman educator. I mean, the two things are so unique. But she was very good at fundraising, and she did a great deal for the football team.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't consider, and she, when we, she first came, she invited all the women professors and to dinner or for lunch or something.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, I didn't see her doing anything that was impressive.
Okay. I know that she was very concerned about minority students.
Yeah, well.
But perhaps that didn't extend to women in science.
I didn't see much difference there either, but I don't know how much she stuck her neck out, frankly.
Okay.
You see, I'm not one of her fans.
Okay.
But you won't get me in trouble. Anyway, let's see. We do research with the members of the Comprehensive Cancer Center who are studying cell lines relative to understanding what causes cancer and what the cancer chromosomes are and so forth. So we've done a lot of work over that over the ages.
Is that an interdisciplinary center?
Well, actually it is. It's a hospital, but most of the people around who have worked in cancer research belong to that.
Okay.
And similarly, the Primate Research Center, which is great, but was heartbreaking. We lost all those monkeys.
When did you lose monkeys?
Oh, they used to have hundreds, and they couldn't afford to keep them anymore. They lost the grant, so they sent them to primate centers elsewhere.
Oh, okay, so it was a lack of money. It was not out of concern for animals. Okay.
No, no. Actually, the monkeys there had a better life than most people. I mean, there's one little monkey that was retarded, and they had two psychology students studying it every day. We ended up writing a paper because it had a genetic defect.
Wow.
But, you know, I mean, that monkey had so much attention. Okay. And then I teach this course for insight to cytogenetics. I used to lecture in the various other courses at the medical school and also in the physician's assistants.
Mm-hmm.
And I could go through my papers, I could refresh my memory. Talked about syndromes. We did colorectal cell lines. And you see, back in 85, yeah, we were working on dioxin. This is the chemical name.
Did the work you did on environmental toxins lead to any of them being banned?
Well, no, but they cut the permissible limits.
Okay.
And then, you know, I'm very interested also in what genetic changes make a cell cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have been working on this in cell lines and elsewhere. And we've identified some. And it's really quite exciting because whether you're a mouse or a man, it's the same genetic sequences. Okay. I know Burkitt's, we started using fish hair. We were the first.
You're the first to start doing research
Fish? Well, we established a strong research thing using fish as fluorescent in situ hybridization.
Okay.
It's a way of studying genes in play in situ.
Okay.
So we developed that, and we used it for, and we still do for certain cancers that you can't be sure of, and the treatment depends on the exact diagnosis.
Okay.
So, like, we just once had a case of a pregnant lady who had a gastric cancer that they thought was a synovial sarcoma, but you wouldn't expect it where it was. It was in the wrong place for that. So the pathologists fight back and forth, so they send us the sections, and we were able to use DNA probes to prove it was a synovial sarcoma, for which the treatment was much easier than the other one, and the survival was much greater. So she was pregnant, and that made a big difference.
Okay.
So that's the kind of thing we do. But it doesn't look, now that I go through this, doesn't look like I've done that much, but it was a lot of work at the time.
No, I think your list of publications is very long. It looks like you've been very busy.
Back when my former husband was at the Advanced Center for Studies in the Social Sciences or something, this man, Jules Henry, was there. He mm-hmm. was one of the people. And he'd written this book called Love Is Not Enough on the origins of autism. And he and I almost came to blows because he believed it was all in the parental attitude.
Really?
And I felt that anything that was so devastating at such a young age had to have a prenatal origin.
And what did he say what mothers were doing that...
Well, he didn't have children. He couldn't yeah. see that some of the things they were doing, they were bouncing in bed with them and things. These were great. I mean, who doesn't?
Okay, so he was blaming...
What most actions. People, yeah, the way they were treating the child, which was totally normal. But what did he know anyway? And people were buying it and trying to modify their behavior and didn't know whether to show more or less love.
Okay.
You know, and it really, it was, and first of all, even if there was any truth to it, I just was deeply appalled at the concept of playing such a guilt trip on people.
Yeah. So contemporary thought is now against him?
Now we know it's genetic.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fully genetic, or is there an environmental component?
I think that anything that's that, everything has got an interaction, and so some people may be genetically predisposed that never develop something.
Okay.
But, you know, anything that's that devastating so early has to have a strong prenatal or genetic influence. I mean, think about the kids that are orphans and left in mm-hmm. homes. I mean, they don't come out like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, they don't get any love. They don't get any fondling. I mean, they live under the worst possible conditions, these little orphans abroad,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
And they come out of it okay, intact. So I really argue against blaming, you know, kids that are so resilient.
Okay. So it sounds like the research you've been involved with has had a lot of sort of impacts on the outside
yeah.
world.
Yeah,
the other.
To some extent, yes. And I've, you know, gotten students going, too.
So that must be exciting to feel like you're affecting the treatment women might get when right. they get breast cancer or how.
I hope to be more effective. The problem is right now that it's not thought that my research abilities are worth it, so I have to spend all my time doing clinical work.
You don't feel like your research is valued these days?
No, I mean, I think that we're now that we have a new a person who is working for tenure in the department, so 90% of his time is spent on research.
And that puts more of the burden of the clinical stuff on you.
And that means he spends 2 hours a week here, and I do all the rest.
Oh, okay.
And it's very hard to get any research done.
Yeah. Okay.
So, I mean, I'm looking forward to having more time and finishing up some things.
Well, do you have any closing comments about your career at UW?
Well, do you have any questions now? I can tell you some pretty nasty things that have happened recently, but I don't know if you want to hear them.
Well, sure, whatever you want to say.
I don't know if you want to even put them in a book.
Well, we don't have to... We wouldn't put
I
them
mean,
in a book.
For example, when we decided that, you know, for years I've been trying to get somebody to help here
mm-hmm.
who could take over when I leave, so we finally hire somebody. And then when I read in the local newspaper that he's now the director of cytogenetics, and I'm a senior cytogeneticist, and this guy had no experience, he had nothing, and he's the one who's doing all this research, he's never here.
So was that his true title, or had the newspaper made a mistake?
No, the administration here didn't think there was anything wrong with that.
Oh, with naming him director and making him
And making
associate.
Me nothing.
Yeah.
No, they didn't make me associate.
Really? They just...
They made me senior cytogeneticist. They created a title that didn't exist.
What did you do about that?
Well, I complained. And finally, I complained enough and pointed out to them that there was a certain degree of discrimination involved here. I mean, here I had 34 years of experience, and he had one, and he did no squat. But by making him director, he's never going to learn.
Okay.
So they finally made us co-directors.
Okay.
Which at least, I mean, it's terrible to be here all day and not have any power in what you say. You know, and not to be able to decide when you need to hire somebody. It was, we had some real disasters here because we were so understaffed, but he didn't know.
Okay. And you feel like that's an example of discrimination where that
Oof.
Happened because he was a man?
Oof. Do you think it would happen if, I mean, can you imagine doing that to anybody? And I didn't even know it had been done until I read it in the paper.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was also illegal in terms of the fact that the lab was left uncovered without director.
Oh, okay.
Since, you know, absentee. So there was a few things like that. And also the whole arrogant attitude that I can't come up with any kind of brilliant research, but he gets full time and two, they pay for two postdocs and technicians to do his.
Okay, and you have no research support?
Nothing. I can't even squeeze out a little extra help from anybody here because of being understaffed. So I think that's a pretty dirty trick. And it's not that, you know, if I suddenly become senile or what.
So things have improved since 1968, but there are still problems.
Well, I don't think, right now I think they're, you know, right now I find that it's pretty disgusting.
Really?
But I don't know what to do about it. I mean, I have improved on it, and I'm going to, I mean, it's very annoying. And I'm getting very upset. And if you want to just click off this, I don't even think you want to hear it.
I can turn this off if you'd like
just
to.
Just for 1 second.
Okay, and I think with that, we're going to conclude today's session.